This is a Gathering History Project podcast recorded in the Louth County Museum in Dundalk, Ireland. Now, my guest today for the Gathering History Project is Martin McCormick. Martin, there's a few different ways of spelling McCormick, but your one is spelled M-C-C-O-R-M-I-C-K, but there's M-A-C-K around Dundalk area as well, isn't there?
That's right, Harry, yes. I don't know too much about this, but I believe that the M-I-C-K McCormick is from Scotland. And then I think the ACK is more of an Irish spelling of McCormick. So I think we're in the minority, and I kind of quite like that we're considered a little bit more special than the Max.
Yeah, because I think that most people, if they were spelling that themselves without seeing it, they would put A instead of I.
That's right, yes, yeah. And it frustrates my mother and you know, some of my relatives that's the case, but it doesn't bother me.
Now, tell me a little bit about, first of all, where you were born, and your mum and your dad. Tell me a little bit about them.
Well, I suppose like a lot of people, you know, sort of in Ireland, my parents grew up in Dundalk, and, you know, I was born in the Louth Hospital here in Dundalk, so that's pretty common, I think, you know, to have two parents from the one town and then grow up in that town, and a lot of my sort of ancestors are from Dundalk then as well. So yeah, we've a long history in Dundalk, going down right through, well, I suppose as far as I can see, you know, it's to great grandparents all from the area and possibly even beyond.
And what did your dad do and his family? What were they connected? What kind of work did they do?
My dad is part of McCormick's. We have a business in town, McCormick's Butchers, and seems to be known wide and far. We're famous for our spicy sausages.
Sausages, yeah.
That's it, Harry. Yeah, you've obviously had them taste them over the years. Famous for our spicy sausages, and that's where my dad grew up, in Church Street in Dundalk.
And was he involved in the business?
He was, I think, up until probably sometime in the 70s when he left the business. So, yeah, then he went on, and I think after he got married and started his family and then pursued a different career in accounting. And
your mum, you said your mum is a Dundalk lady, and where is she from?
Mum is from Hagerstown area, and is Anne Quinn is her maiden name, and so Anne, Larry and Mona Quinn from Mulla Harlan in, you know, Hagerstown. And my granddad used to be in is it McCann's bakery, I think. That's where he started out, and you know, I was on the road there for many years.
Was that the time of the horse and cart?
I don't know if there was definitely horse and carts along the way somewhere. I don't know if my granddad was. I think that might be more my great grandparents. It probably would have been when they grew up. Yeah, there was horse and carts around then. I know my granny talks about horse and carts going down Mulla Harlan Road. That's right. The pony and trap, is that what they call them?
Or you'd go to Mass of a Sunday in the pony and trap.
That's right, yeah. I've heard stories of bare feet and all that.
You've heard all of that.
Yeah, that's right, yes. In first year school in Hagerstown many years ago. So, yeah, hard to believe that's sort of, you know, there's people alive that still talk about that, and that's my granny. Yeah.
And what school did you go to?
St. Fursey School in Hagerstown.
Oh, yeah. That's where you went to school?
That's where I went as well, yeah. So I would have been there between 84 to 89 or sort of early 80s anyway. Yeah.
Now, those small schools, comfort schools, as somebody said to me one time about them, that then when you moved into secondary school, the difference between going to a small school like Hagerstown and a secondary school, did you find that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, we'd be going on our bicycles across country roads to get to Hagerstown School. You know, quite a sheltered and, you know, beautiful sort of childhood in many ways. But yeah, getting on the bus then and going to a town school, you know, secondary school in town, was quite a big and different experience for us. So yeah, going from a small school to one, I think we had 1,200 pupils in the De La Salle school in Dundalk, so it was a huge change for me, but a great change.
What did you do at school? Like, were you into music after? I mean, as a recreation, not recreation, but a playtime. Like, were you into football, music? What were you into?
You know, I look back, Harry, at that time, and I really realize I really wasn't interested in that much. And when I look at and compare myself to some of my schoolmates, you know, who were always into sports or other things like that. Yeah, I didn't have much interest. I suppose my interest was art and, you know, things kind of creative, but the school didn't really kind of, wasn't really something that they were pushing. So it was more of an academic school. I was a creative person. I probably didn't kind of sort of maybe sort of fit in too much, you know. But yeah, I enjoyed my time there at a great secondary school time, and I enjoyed my time with friends. So we just kind of hang out at lunchtime, and we'd have great crack and we'd be playing board games and things like that. But yeah, sports was definitely not my thing.
And did the same idea when you went to the De La Salle too, as regards sports? Because it's very difficult to go to secondary school and not get involved in sport, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I suppose that's just sort of, I find in life in general, like, you know, I've even find now, it's like, yeah, who do you support, you know? And I have to reluctantly say, nobody really. I don't really have any interest. And people look at you almost in horror, the fact that you don't have a team or, yeah, you know, it's almost like, well, what's wrong with you? I just don't have much passion for sport. And that's just me. Yeah.
Now, would what we know now, Martin, and that you are gay, and at that time, Martin, was there an idea in your head that you might, with not playing sport, particularly not playing sport, that maybe you were slightly different than the rest of the school? There was only boys there in that school, yeah, at that time, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was aware that I was different, you know, probably from a very early age. I suppose I wasn't sure what to call it, and I wasn't quite sure, you know, how I was feeling, but I knew, yeah, I probably was attracted to guys and not girls, but it really wasn't only until I was about 18 that I kind of, you know, sort of thought, right, I'm definitely gay, you know, and yeah, there's just no doubt in my mind. And but I remained in the closet right throughout school and right through college. It wasn't until after I left college, you know, in my early 20s before I actually came out to family and friends.
Martin, it must have been very, very difficult, though, hiding it. And were you very noticeably gay, shall we say?
Well, I don't think so, Harry. Maybe other people did, but no. And no, I've got to be honest, I don't think anybody really knew. And yeah, I guess I was lucky in a way that I didn't get bullied. You know, I never got called names, you know. Yeah, I was sort of lucky that I wasn't sort of tortured in that way, like so many.
Because
other
it could easily have
so happened. Many other kids are, and you know, sort of bullied to the point that they can't take it anymore. I certainly wasn't one of those kids. Yeah, it was. I had a great time in secondary school. I had great friends and you know, a great best friend. We just had such a laugh together, and so I guess the kind of the bullying is sort of and the prejudice and the hate and all of that was sort of much more indirect. You know, it's coming from society at large, and you're picking up all these kind of sort of beliefs and views very indirectly through media, or I suppose the church being such a huge force, you know, in the community and in my life at the time as well. So that's really sort of where you're picking up all of these signals, and you know, you take them on board, and because these are such powerful influences in your life around you, you know, it affects you internally. But that's what I did. I internalized them and kind of, you know, buried them and really tried not to let them hurt me, but of course they did. They hurt me a lot.
And Martin, when things came up like the Debs or anything like that, did you go to the Debs and was this something to show that you're the same as the rest of
them?
That's
right, yeah. I guess the Debs, of course, I invited a girl and was uncomfortable about it. She was probably more uncomfortable than I was.
And did she know anything about you?
No, she wouldn't. Again, I would have been so in the closet at the time that, I guess nobody knew. Maybe she did. Actually, be interesting to go and try suss her out now and find out what had she any inkling. I was just very much in the closet, and I don't think, I expressed myself very well, and I don't think anybody really knew, the real me.
You had two sisters, mm-hmm. Adele and Teresa,
right.
And your mum and dad, of course, at the time. Did they have any idea at that time that you were gay?
And throughout secondary school, I don't think so. Maybe they had maybe they suspected a little. I had been going out to the teenage discos, and I didn't have girlfriends. I dated one or two girls for a little while, very, very short periods. So maybe, they probably didn't suspect. They probably just thought, he's just like any of my other friends. They're only really starting to, experiment with those sort of things at that age. It wasn't really until later on then that they began to really suspect.
Now, you went to what college did you go to?
So I went to the College of Marketing and Design in Dublin to study, it was called environmental design at the time, which is sort of three-dimensional design, everything got to do with designing in 3D, whether that be interiors, exhibition, stage and set, furniture, and so on. So I did that for 4 years in Dublin, and I ended up specialising in furniture design with interior design as a backup. And I've pursued a career in that field ever since then.
During your time in that college, Martin, that was in Dublin, I presume?
That's right, yeah.
And did you get involved, we'd say, in the gay scene in Dublin?
Not at all, Harry, no. Again, I remained in the closet for that whole period. And yeah, again, I look back and I kind of regret not making a move at that time. But, that's what happened, and I can't change anything. And I suppose in some ways I think I missed an opportunity there to just sort of break out. And but anyway, I what happened, and again, everything happens for a reason. I focused on my work and on my career, and so I didn't really have much distractions in college. I put my head down, and I got a good grade at the end, and obviously went off from there. And it really wasn't until after college then that I began to think, I really need to do something about this.
When you say do something about it, Martin, are you saying that to get involved in the gay scene, or to the most important thing, to let your family know?
Well, I just thought, I suppose in college, I just thought I'll never come out. I didn't want to disappoint my parents. I suppose I was thinking of myself, but also thinking about their reaction. And deep down, I suppose I was fearful of them rejecting me. And, my parents, my dad in particular, were quite religious. And so I was conscious of their beliefs and knew that this wouldn't fit with their beliefs, and I suppose just wanted to avoid any confrontation or upsetting the family in any way. So I just thought, I'll never ever come out. And maybe if it was left to me, I probably would have never come out. I don't know, but events took on by themselves and almost forced me to sort of come out. And what happened, I discovered probably during college, I think it was, when I discovered that my younger sister was gay. And this came as quite a shock to me. I didn't suspect at all. Like, it's funny how, you know, all the signs were probably there, but I just didn't think about it. She was always quite a tomboy. But I just thought that was ideal. I just never really kind of, it didn't dawn on me.
In your mind now, there was two of your mother and father's three children didn't know about either at that time.
And that's kind of what, instead of it actually helping the situation, knowing that I had another sibling who was gay, it made things worse. I just thought, how can I ever come out now? There's two of the three children that are gay. It sort of just almost compounded the problem and made it even worse. The problem got bigger. So I didn't talk to my younger sister about it.
And why did you not do that? I was just going to ask you that.
Yeah, because of this, I just didn't want to.
Did she know you again?
She might have suspected, but again, because I kind of wasn't out, and you know, I hadn't got any gay friends, she had no reason to believe otherwise. So, but it put me further into the closet. When I found out that she was gay. So
did you come home on a regular basis and sit in the house as if there was nothing wrong? And it must have been tearing it apart.
Yeah, you're going through it, and you're not really. You don't realise maybe what the signals you're giving off. You know, I probably was becoming quieter and a little bit more withdrawn, but I didn't realise I was doing that. You know, but it was picked up on at home. And there were times, like, you know, I'd go home at the weekend, and sometimes I would, you know, I'd get into bed on a Saturday. So, you know, I just felt tired. And, you know, maybe, obviously, there was stuff going on for me emotionally. I didn't realize it was that was so draining. And, it's hard trying to be something that you're not. It takes a lot of effort, and it takes a lot of energy.
Now, I have to come in here and just say Adele, who, of course, unfortunately died. And when I was on radio, I did a wonderful interview with her about her illness, and she was going to Mexico for treatment and everything. So I got to know Adele that time with the two interviews I did. But knowing at that time for a good while that Adele was not going to make it, that she was going to die, must have been very, very difficult. But at that time, were you able to talk to each other about being gay?
Yes, you know, going back, it's 18 years ago now. It was about 1995 when I eventually confided in to my older sister about the situation, and you know, Adele was there at the time, so you know, Trace was aware that we were both gay, and you know, had no problem with it at all. She was very accepting, and I guess I wasn't fearful of her knowing, because I did think that's the way she would react. So what happened was, although we confided in Trace, she felt obliged to actually tell my mum and dad, you know, that we were gay, and she did the right thing in doing so. And then my dad ended up coming to Dublin one time. That's where I was living, you know, and working, and actually confronting me and then asking me.
Did you know he was coming up?
I didn't. I knew he was coming up on an errand, but and when I found out he was making the trip, I instantly knew that that's what it was to ask me. An inner voice telling me that it was time. And at that just by the time I got to that stage, I thought, yes, this has to be done. There's no turning back now. I can't deny it. And it was a difficult time for all of us, but again, a necessary step and one of the best things I've ever done in my life.
Now, we'll just mention the book now in a second, but your dad that night took you home.
That's right.
To meet your mum for the first time since. Was that difficult for you?
Yes, absolutely. Probably one of the most difficult things I've ever experienced. And it's just, you know, it's years of repressing all your feelings and emotions and thoughts and words, and it all erupting sort of and coming to the surface in one meeting, even though nothing was said. Absolutely nothing was said. We just got home and arrived, and my mother was there waiting, and we just embraced and cried.
She says a lovely little piece in the book where it was just coming. She was 50. She was just coming to the age where the kids are growing up, and it's a nice Catholic family, and everything was lovely and rosy. And then all of a sudden, she got this news. It must have been very difficult for her.
Absolutely, I think you know you have to look at it in context. You know, my two parents are from a different generation to when I grew up. So, you know, things were difficult when I was growing up, but for them growing up, the word gay meant happy, you know, and homosexual, it was one of the worst things ever, you know. So they hadn't been exposed to many things gay. They hadn't really got any gay friends. They only knew maybe one or two people out there in the world, and maybe TV or celebrity, so it didn't have a very good meaning. In fact, quite the opposite. So for two of the three children to reveal that they're gay, the world fell apart. I think that's what the words that they use.
But your dad, Martin, handled it very, very well. He took a very positive outlook. Now, just tell me the little story about what he was doing, and then you finding the file, and then we just mentioned then about the book, tell our listeners about it. But tell me that story.
I think he did struggle. Like, he was torn between his religious beliefs and then the actual reality in his family. So, you know, he was really, really torn emotionally, and he did struggle, but he was probably a little bit more practical in terms of how he dealt with it. So, you know, he almost took a business-like approach to seeing how he could almost solve the problem, even though there didn't need to be solved. But, you know, how can we help this situation? He described it as a crisis in the family, and yeah, he's a bit more pragmatic and reached out looking for information and sought answers to his many questions. So I think actually one of the first things that happened, they confided in a priest who was an uncle of my mother, you know, and that was one of the first places that they went to. And, where my uncle was understanding, at the same time, you know, he was very firm in his beliefs, and so it was difficult for all of us, especially I think Edel and myself. We he suggested that we pray to God, you know, and you know everything would be okay. It was almost what they call now pray away the gay. And so I don't know if it really helped at all. It certainly kind of, I struggled with that kind of, you know, belief or view. So then after that, then he started maybe going to places like Dundalk Outcomers here in town. And meeting with the...
Which was a wonderful thing for a man of his religious beliefs even to go down to a place like the Outcome, wasn't it?
It was, because I wouldn't have been prepared to do it then. So
just explain the Outcomers, of course, is the gay place in Dundalk. Was it in Roden Place there?
Yeah, and, you know, the fact that it even existed then is incredible. Like, you know, Dundalk was very lucky to have, something like that in the town, which many other towns around the country didn't have any facility like that, and still don't, you know. So and as we know, that's mainly down to Bernardine Quinn, you know, for setting that up, and she was way ahead of her time in many ways. So that's the first place, or one of the first places, that he went to seek help. And he met with Bernadine and Colette O'Regan then, who were project workers in the centre. And yeah, they were able to offer him some advice, and it was just a place where he could kind of talk openly and not be afraid about what they might think. So yeah, it was a good place to start. He also contacted PFLAG in Dublin, which is again a sort of a support and befriending group for parents. So it's an acronym, so it's Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gays. And I remember him contacting, yeah, a lady who sort of was head of the Dublin branch. And he also put anonymous ads in the local newspapers, then inviting other parents, you know, to come forward. Now, this is we came out in 1995, so this is, you know, a few years after that. It just all didn't happen at once, you know. It was a slow process going through all of this. And, yeah, the amazing thing is that, you know, he put in these anonymous ads in the Argus and the Democrat, and parents did call him. You know, he had a mobile phone number. He met them very secretly, you know, and I think it was outside St. Patrick's Cathedral here in the car park, you know. And, I guess it was him searching, you know, although he was probably hoping to help them. He needed help himself, you know. He needed to find other people in similar situations so he could find out how they were going and how they were sort of coming to terms with this whole situation.
And then he asked friends and acquaintances to write a letter, which wasn't very successful.
Yeah, his initial idea was to form a support group like PFLAG in Dundalk for parents and friends of lesbians and gay kids. And so he invited people, and they were interested but were reluctant to get involved, and they all made excuses for various reasons. And then he invited each of the family members to write their story, and he wanted to gather the stories and compile them in a book and gather stories from other parents and children and gay children, and then put them in a book and then make those stories in a book available at the meetings. So he had a poor response to everything. You know, he had a poor response to the forming the support group, and he had a poor response to the writing of the stories. And I did, this is sort of now, we came out in 95, it's about the year 2000 now, when he's at this stage of inviting people to write stories. And I did write a story at that time, but I didn't complete it and I didn't send it to him. So, yeah.
He wrote one himself.
He did write his own story, and again, I think it was in about sort of the year 2000 that he did that, and you know, that sort of went into his file, which is called PFLAG file, and it remained there for several years, and I found it after he died.
He died very quite soon, within a few months.
Yeah, he was diagnosed. He was diagnosed with a brain tumor in 2003, and it progressed quickly. And he was, although he received good treatment and that, he died 6 months later. So
that must have been a very difficult time for you, knowing what he went through for the last couple of years.
Yeah, I guess I don't really kind of relate the two together, because I felt that although it was sort of a difficult time in around 95, things had got better, and you know, so we had got to the stage where we were able to talk about things and not hide anything. So, you know, he'd been on quite a journey at that stage, and so yeah, if we came out in 95, this was 2003, 8 years later. But you know, we had, and the great thing is that we did come out then, and then, you know, we're connecting with each other.
Martin, can I just ask you, it was at this stage, was Adele chatting to him about the same as you?
Yes, yeah, we would be both very open. She had a girlfriend and was living with her at the time, and you know, my dad was very supportive of their relationship, and you know, would go out for a drink with the two of them, and so yeah, things had changed a lot, and it was great that we had got to that stage where we could just be ourselves, and he's part of our lives, and we're not afraid to hold anything back from him. So,
The next big stage in your life, of course, would be Adele's illness and her death.
Mm. Yeah, so not long after Dad died, Adele was diagnosed with breast cancer, and you know, this came as a great shock to us, you know, because we had, not alone had we buried my dad, but we'd buried my uncle Jerry, my dad's brother, and my dad's sister, my auntie Anne. So there was six siblings, you know, of my dad's generation, all age 60, all killed with cancer. And so we had a very, very bad experience in our family of cancer. And so when we found out Adele was diagnosed with cancer, yeah, it's just sort of just a shock and fear goes through everybody, obviously in particular Adele. And the diagnosis from the outset wasn't good. We knew that, you know, it already had advanced from, you know, her breast to her lymph nodes under her arm. So we knew that she was going to have a tough battle ahead.
Martin, do you found when you found the book and then you decided that you were going to take up where your father left off and try and get this book done?
Well, we since my dad was diagnosed in 2003, and then, you know, Adele was diagnosed, you know, about was it a year and a half later? And then she was sick for 3.5 years. Like, so for all of that time, you know, our family was consumed with sickness and dying and death and the aftermath of death, you know, living sort of after somebody has died and then coping with all of that. So the project was certainly not a priority at that stage. It was, that's what consumed all of us emotionally. And so really it wasn't until sort of you start moving beyond that and climbing out of that then, you know, I began thinking about the book again. And so I did this course about a year and a half ago in Melbourne, which was called Landmark Forum. And it was three parts of the course, and the third part was all about creating a community project. And I knew that this was my project. It was, you know, it was yelling at me that this needed to be done. So, you know, there were other people in the course not sure what to do, but we all were led in different directions. But to me, yeah, I had thought about doing or continuing on with my dad's project, you know, ages ago, but it was only when I finished the course that I thought, yeah, this is mine.
So you got around to getting in contact with a lot of relatives and friends and people who had relationships with Adele and yourself.
That's right. You know, so the first thing I did was to dig up the file that was at home, and my mother got that for me. And it included my dad's story, it included a poem from Adele, and it included another letter from a very good friend of ours to my dad, and it also included a lot of research that he'd done at the time, you know, information that he got from PFLAG. It included copies of the ads that he put in the paper. So that, it also included a framework for the book. You know, so it had even sort of the chapter set out and the format, and it had the title of the book, which is My Son.
He did all of that. Tell us the title again.
The title is My Son, My Daughter, Myself.
It's an unbelievable title, isn't it?
It is very powerful, yeah. I love the title, I must say. It's, I think it's arresting.
Yeah, and My Son, My Daughter, and Myself. There's something.
Yeah, that's right. I've had friends say to me that if they saw that on a bookshelf, like they would pick it up. They'd almost, it's intriguing. Yeah, We'd want to read it.
Now, Martin, the book itself is to be published and launched. It is ready and everything like that. And I have to say, I read the book since Martin gave it to me over the weekend. And you don't have to be involved in the gay scene or anything at all. The book is powerful. And it's so easy to read because it's all these letters, wee stories that all these people have written. And some sad, some funny, but really very, very readable. Tell me a little bit about the launch.
So I'll just go back a little bit, if you don't mind.
Of course, yeah.
You did ask me there about, I did invite family, friends and relatives, you know, to write stories. So I suppose my dad's initial idea was to get parents and their gay children to write stories. I've sort of expanded it a little bit beyond that. So, you know, I've invited friends and relatives, you know, and so it's a little bit broader than maybe what he had intended. And just as you said, they're all personal stories, some letters, but the thing that I suppose unites them all together is that everybody speaks from the heart. They're very authentic stories. And maybe it's because my dad's story, which is the first story in the book, and I sent that story to everybody, which is such a powerful and heartfelt story, and again, a very honest story, that it gave everybody the license then to do the same. And so I think that all the stories that followed are very authentic stories, and they're very real. And I think when people speak so authentically, you can connect with anybody who
the story about your dad, which, as you say, which is the first, and it sets the tone for the rest of the book.
That's right. Yeah, it's just somebody speaking honestly about how they felt, good, bad, or otherwise, you know.
So the book launch is, you know, we are here in the museum on, what day is today? The 19th, isn't it? The 19th of November, and on Monday morning. And when is the launch?
So the launch is taking place in Dundalk Outcomers on Saturday night, the 23rd of November, and 7:30 launch. And looking forward to it. We've got, I've invited everybody who's contributed stories in the book to come, and they'll be coming with their friends and hopefully some relatives as well. Senator Mary Morin is going to be there as guest speaker on the night, and I'm hoping that we'll have somebody read out my dad's story, and there'll be somebody from Outcomers are actually hosting it, and we've a lot to be thankful to them.
And where will the book be available then after that?
So the book is currently available online, and you can buy it on blurb.com, so that's blurb.com/bookstore. And if you just type in the title of the book, My Son, My Daughter, Myself, you'll find the book there available for sale. It's currently for sale, I think it's at €8.90, so it's quite cheap. It's only a small book, plus shipping, and that's where you can get it at the moment. It will be available on other websites soon. I didn't mention that it's self-published, so, you know, we're doing all of this ourselves. And, all proceeds from sale will go to Dundalk Outcomers. So we're not in to make any money, but we do want to spread the word and make it available to as many people as possible, because I do think that, although things have changed in Ireland since we came out, you know, all those years ago, there's still so many people in the same situation, maybe confronted with this situation for the very first time in their life. And I think a book of such as this will help them.
Now let's move on, Martin, a little bit about, you have been in Australia on two occasions. Tell me about the first occasion that you went out there.
Well, the first time I went was with the guy I was going out with at the time, which is in 1997, and it was quite an adventure. I really hadn't really thought about going to Australia until Seamus, you know, came up with the idea. I was enjoying my job in Dublin at the time, and so I just thought, why not? Let's go. And so we were only going out on a 1-year working holiday visa at the time. Arrived in Sydney. It was just such an amazing experience, you know, to be in such a beautiful city. Again, lovely weather. And it was home from home. I don't know if you've been to Australia, but in many ways, it's like Ireland and the UK.
Only with the good weather.
Exactly what I was going to say. I know a friend of mine said it's like Ireland with a roof on, and I thought that's a brilliant way to describe Australia. It culturally, yeah, it's very similar, but it's just a totally different.
And what did you do? What did you work at out there, Martin, at that time?
So I continued on in the same field. I was working for a design firm in Sydney initially, and then one day I was going out looking at a project, I picked up the Irish newspaper in the train station, the Irish Echo at the time, and here I see an ad for the Irish Pub Company setting up an office in Sydney, and I thought, oh, that's interesting, and I'll kind of drop them a line and just out of curiosity, and within a couple of months I was that person. I filled that job and was looking after a small satellite office for the Irish Pub Company in Sydney, building Irish.
That must have been interesting.
It was, yeah. It was quite different for me, coming from what I was doing to doing that, because it sort of meant that, like, I left designing full time and then going into more of a project management role. In fact, very much a sales role, because I was representing the company out there, and I'd be meeting clients, you know, for the first time, taking the brief, then sending that brief back to Dublin and dealing with the designers and liaising with them, and then they would do the design work, and then I would again be that contact person on the ground in Sydney, looking after these Irish pubs around Australia. So
would it be called a good job? Like, were you well paid?
I think I was relatively well paid at the time. Yeah,
I think you were overpaid the way you're smiling.
No. They probably think I was, but I think they got their money's worth.
So how long were you there then? How long did you stay?
Staying another 4 years then after I got that job. Yeah, so they sponsored me to stay in Australia, and I had a great time. You know, it was an awesome job going around to Australia and New Zealand. And in fact, in the early days, yeah, I was in some projects in Asia as well. So, you know, we were involved in a pub in Japan. I looked at projects in Fiji. I was in Singapore.
Would you travel there?
Yes, I've been to all of those countries. Work related. But then that was sort of initially, but the majority of my time was really in Australia, going around Australia. So I got to see a lot of Australia through my job, and then building Irish pubs. And
so what took you home then?
Well, at 4 years in that job, I think it was coming to the end of my sponsorship. I was sort of considering maybe going back then at the end of that time and going back. You know, Ireland, obviously, this was sort of coming up to about 2002, you know.
It was just starting, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, we were well into the kind of the good years in Ireland at that stage. And, you know, obviously I'd heard a lot of stories of friends who were doing very well in Ireland. So that was enticing, you know, maybe coming back and enjoying some of the boom time, even though I wasn't sure, you know, how long more it would last. But another factor in the equation was that, like, you know, in Sydney, I was single at this stage. I'd kind of got into the gay scene. I was partying an awful lot. You know, I'd gone out at the weekend and, getting a bit wasted and, you know, sort of recovering during the week.
Were you a bit concerned about that?
I was very concerned, yeah. I was just conscious of it. Like, this is what I was doing. And, although I was performing quite well in my job and, sort of doing what I had to do there, you know, in my personal life, yes, I recognize that it may be not the most constructive thing to be doing. And I felt like it was really, there was only one way of getting out of it was by breaking the cycle completely and leaving it. So that was a big factor in me coming home.
And do you count yourself lucky that you were capable of doing that, Martin?
Yeah, I guess looking back, it was a good move, and it was a necessary move, and a necessary move in many reasons, because that was 2002. It was just months after I got back that my dad was diagnosed with cancer, and then, you know, everything else that followed. So
I was here
for all of that. So it was such a wise move on many levels.
Now, your second trip back.
So yeah, I haven't got to Ireland in 2002. I, you know, got back into a job in Dublin, into the firm that I used to work for, before I left to go to Australia. Some great years, obviously. You know, Ireland was booming. I bought a house and renovated it, and, you know, sort of, well, I was in the, in on the ride just like everybody else, and some great years. Then, you know, Adele got sick, and in the last sort of 6 months of her life, well, her friend had, you know, given up his job and moved in with her to look after her, and then, you know, when he had sort of done a good stint, and I decided to take on from Kevin, and so I left my job and I moved in with Adele. And again, this was just around sort of the end of 2007, just as things started to, you know, fall apart.
And you lived with her to look after her during the final?
I did. I was only with her for the last maybe sort of 4 months, I think. Yeah, just living with her in her own house. And so again, I was lucky, you know, to be able to do that and, you know, spend some quality time with her. And, you know, I think it was the Lehman Brothers crash happened at the end of 2007, and, you know, everything else started to decline after that. So, you know, by the time, you know, after Adele died, and you know, that was into 2008, you know, it was just, there was no job there for me when I came out of all of that. Like, yeah, there was, everybody was being made redundant in my old firm, and then, you know, eventually that went bust. You know, was employing over 100 people at the time I was working in it, and it was booming, but yeah, there was nothing to go back to then. So it was at that stage that I started to, you know, basically work for myself. I was picking up small jobs, doing, you know, house extensions and planning applications and things like that. And but it really just wasn't enough to survive. You know, I'd got in the boom, you know, got my house with a hefty mortgage. I'd acquired another investment property, just as so many of us did. So yeah, huge, still huge outgoings, but very little coming in. And I had then a call from an old client of mine in Australia. He'd heard that I hadn't got much work, and so he offered me a job and an opportunity to come back out to work for him directly in Melbourne, and that's what I did. I ended up
And that was how many years ago now?
That's about 4 years ago now.
And you're still there?
I am. Again, you know, he wasn't giving me a long-term commitment. He was just saying, look, come out. I'll have worked maybe for, you know, 9 to 12 months. And, yeah, I'm still there in that job. So, you know, I feel very fortunate that I got that call and I got that opportunity to come back. And,
And are you just home now for a break? Do you come home often?
I do come home. I try to get home every year. You know, I try to make an annual visit. I don't want to leave it any longer. You know, so much sort of changes in that time. I wish I could come home more often. I wish I could just drop in and out when I want, but, you know, life is just not like that. Time and money, so there are limitations. But yeah, once a year is good. I get to see my family and friends, and, you know, it's short, and it tends to be quite hectic, but it's quality time, and I love coming home.
When you come back to Dundalk now, Martin, and knowing from growing up and everything in Dundalk, what is the one thing that you see such a change in, for the good or for the bad?
Both. Well, I'd start with the good. I mean, one of the nicest things about coming home, clearly there's family and friends and all the connections. Life here, it just seems so much more real. So when I come home, I feel very connected to place and people. Such a strong sense of belonging and community that I don't have over there. You know, I have a great life in Australia, but in some ways it feels like a bubble. It almost feels like a little bit of a fantasy. You know, you just don't have that depth of connection with people or place. But as soon as you arrive home, it's just, it's deep, you know. It goes back hundreds of years, it's and beyond. So that's a beautiful feeling, you know, to be around that. And then I suppose the slightly negative is obviously we're going through a recession and still very much in that recession. And so, you look around and the physical environment does look a little bit sort of neglected and just a bit tired, you know, Dundalk, it's very sad to see, you know, the town centre here and so many shops closed and very little traffic on the streets. I remarked about that, you know, when I met first, and that you know, getting here is a breeze, you know, whereas it wasn't like that, you know, in the good days. So that's sad. But, you know, no matter what we're going through in terms of the economy, that the people and the spirit of the people and the spirit of the place is as strong as ever. So nothing will ever kill that. So and nothing will ever kill the humour or the spirit of the Irish people. So, yeah, it's only one aspect of Ireland, you know, is the kind of day-to-day. And it is a harsh reality for a lot of people. Like, you know, it is a lot of stress and struggling. But no, you'll never kill the spirit.
So when are you going back to Australia?
So I'll go back Monday next week and then back to Melbourne. So probably back, if it won't be until another year before I'm back again.
Well, Martin, can I thank you very much indeed for coming in and talking to me this morning. And it's been an absolute pleasure. And as I say, my only memories of the whole thing about the book and everything is with Adele, which I fondly remember with great love and affection for her. She's a wonderful, wonderful girl. Who, and the book is My Son, My Daughter, Myself. Martin, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Harry, and thanks for the opportunity to speak to you. It was a pleasure.
Help us make history by visiting our website on www.gatheringhistory.com.